Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. Now, a few weeks ago, it would have been Jaka instead of me giving you that introduction. Alas, sadly for me and the other RCP staffers, Jaka is graduating from the University of Minnesota and leaving us. Now, in Jaka's honor, we have decided to devote the next 30 minutes to looking at just some of the reporting she's done with us over the last year and a half. That includes her time as a reporter, a producer, and the years she spent as a managing editor.
I transferred from Duluth, and I knew that I wanted to be involved in the radio station. So I emailed Sydney, and Sydney was like, oh, hey, by the way, you said you had some audio experience. We have a podcast. Did you know that? And I was like, oh, I did not. And then I went and I met up with Patrick, and I started volunteering for RCP. And then from there, and then Patrick graduated, and then I was managing editor this whole past year. So 2 years with the lovely, lovely podcast. I think one of my favorite stories was definitely Standing Rock. That was an amazing experience. There's a lot at stake at Standing Rock.
After hundreds of years of oppression, genocide, the culture is alive, the spirituality is alive, and it's very strong.
That's Bob Cohen. He was working on a documentary at Standing Rock.
And it's amazing how resilient they are. And I think they're really an example to all of us about resilience, resistance. And we have to learn a lot. That's the thing. We need to learn. And we've got a huge amount to learn from them.
Mm-hmm. Cohen started his career in media as a reporter for CNN in Zimbabwe, covering the struggle for independence from Britain. Here at Standing Rock, he sees something similar.
It's real. You can touch colonialism and settler colonialism. And we don't talk about colonialism in America, but this is what it's about. And, you know, history sometimes can seem a little abstract and something you can't touch. You just read in the books. But this is living history. You know, you're actually touching what America, well, the myth of America is built upon.
Mm-hmm. To Cohen, colonialism is so palpable and real, and yet the media doesn't always acknowledge colonialism by name.
You know, we have created a sort of a false narrative that has been fed to us through education, through films, through culture, and so people don't have an understanding. It's also a conceptual thing. People, it's not something that most people understand and can relate to it all. So there's a whole lot of learning and relearning that has to happen.
Mm-hmm. Cohen isn't the only one who felt this sort of dissatisfaction with the media. Patience Alonga and Justin are two young reporters from the Black Liberation Project. To them, social media is the way to get the whole truth.
How do you guys feel from what you've seen the media, like how good of a job or bad of a job has the media done covering this whole Standing Rock protest?
Well, I think that's an interesting question because most of what I've seen of what has been happening here has been through Twitter and through the followers that, you know, I follow on social media. And so my go-to has been like other social media accounts that are either already on the ground because the news and media has not been doing a great job of really displaying what is happening here in North Dakota.
I'd say similar to what Patience said, most of the time when I pay attention to media, it's people on Twitter or even Unicorn Ride, who are from Minneapolis, that we actually used to organize with. And so mainstream media, I haven't seen a lot of stuff. I really tend to ignore it. So most of my news has been coming from people on Twitter, independent news sources. So I'd say if you're asking about mainstream media, they've done a poor job. But other than that, like, the movement has found ways to build autonomy and solidarity through other forms of media, which I think is powerful. I'm interested in coalition building, and I think the Black struggle and Indigenous struggle are tied up within each other. And so I think it's important to see how we can build coalitions between movements, between the Black Lives Matter movement and the American Indian movement, or the, you know, No DAPL movement. And so I'm interested to see how people here are organizing, building power, and how we can bring these movements together.
Much of the media is quick to report on the protests that take a turn for the violent and leave out a lot of stories of peaceful prayers at the camps.
What about the media? There's obviously a lot of press here, myself included. Mm-hmm. How do you feel that, with what you've seen in the news, how do you feel that the press has done, have they done their job in covering this?
So far, the media, as long as y'all guys are covering that we are unarmed, we are protectors, we are here, just here to protect the water. We're not here to pick a fight. We're not here to start a war. They're over there dressed for war. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessary.
That's Andre Wensi. He's from McLeod, Oklahoma, with the Kickapoo tribe. While media coverage of the camps is an issue, there's other problems within the camp.
You know, they just drop their water bottles and they don't pick up their trash, and they just treat it like a state fair. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you've been to a state fair, you see trash everywhere by the end of the night. This is not a fair. I've heard that this is a sacred area. And my grandma told me that if it's a sacred, if it's somebody's home, you treat it with respect.
So what exactly does it take to be a good ally? Jerry from Fort Collins has a few ideas.
Well, talk about it, of course, is the number one thing. Spread the word. Let everyone know what's going on here. I encourage everyone to send an email, text, letter, phone call to President Obama, their congressman, the governor of this state. You just flood their phones with positive messages of support for these people, that even if you don't show up, there's so much you can do from home. You can check in to GoFundMe or any of these sites and, you know, just send them money, any kind of help, Amazon.
Just ask questions. Find elders. Elders know a lot. I mean, they're pretty easy to identify, you know, and ask them questions and they'll tell you. They'll tell you real bluntly. Because that's just the way it is. They may sound rude about it, but you gotta respect them.
Right.
And they're like that all around the world. Blunt and, you know, just short, sweet, and to the point. Ask permission if you're going to do something that you think is questionable or you think is right. Even though if you're 100% sure it's right, it's always good to have permission to have that 100%.
That's Wensi again. By asking questions, we can learn a lot from Native culture, a culture that's very much alive. Here, when Armstrong was the last person I talked to before we left camp, he's a Native man, and he thinks that there's a lot people can take from Native ways.
Like everybody says, once you come here, you're being drawn back again. It's like a spiritual thing. And people that come around all the time, they always say that, you know, something draws them over. It's because of the sacredness of here, the spirituality of here. It draws people back over all the time. And we're all here for one common thing, and that's to try to stop the pipeline. Prayer and commonality and solidarity, yeah. That's what we put forth from the Lakota people, and that is prayer and compassion and loving each other, mm-hmm. and caring for each other. That's our nature, Lakota people.
Reporting for Radio K from Standing Rock, this is Jacob Maldonado Medina. I also really liked, I went to Duluth and did a piece about the Great Lakes Aquarium up there, and that one was really fun. I had the flu while I was reporting that one, so that wasn't fun, but it was really fun because the guy was really obsessed with fish, and he was so hyped, and he had named all his fish, and it was really cute, and that one had a lot of fun sound to play with, so I like when I have stories that have like a lot of really fun sounds to put in. When you walk into the Great Lakes Aquarium, you're met with a huge open space with lots of window letting in a ton of light and a beautiful view of Canal Park and the famous Duluth Lift Bridge. There's a huge wall with water trickling down it, and right off the bat, the aquarium was completely different than what I had imagined it to be. I was at the aquarium to talk to Jay Walker. He's the director of operations for the aquarium, and he's been with them for almost 18 years now. He's seen the aquarium go through some changes.
There's been a change in attitude toward the facility. You know, we've definitely had sort of a rocky start when we began. So there's just some local attitudes toward it have changed to being more of a positive, to having a positive impact on the community.
It seems natural that there'd be some skepticism towards the aquarium. Why would people want to see animals that they could probably see on their own? And that's been part of the challenge for the aquarium. How do you get people excited to see things that they see every day?
When you look at a pond, you know, there's pretty cool stuff going on there. There's just some a really neat balance of ecosystem. There's really cool animals that live there, what we didn't even think about. So I think for us, that was the key, is to how do we give people a connection with something that's right outside their door that you take for granted? How do we create the enthusiasm that it deserves?
For Jay, that enthusiasm can be created through some guidance and education.
It's really easy to get a connection with, say, a koala bear, right? But yet, you say, you know, sunfish, per se, or bass, or, you know, those are not your, first off, depending on who you talk to, I think they're beautiful fish, but there's a lot of people that may look at it and say, you know, they're just not as colorful as, like, a coral reef display. And then you look at some of our local animals, and they're, you know, they're green, they're brown, they're striped, you know, they live in weeds, and so you sort of have this, you're it's hard to see that beauty. Our job is to say, oh no, there's a lot of interesting stuff going on here. We just want to kind of point you in the right direction of what's cool. You know, why do you want to care about them? Like, you have to connect with an animal. And once you can make a connection, it gives you a different attitude towards it. You actually want to, you have more care for their environment that they're in. You have a more of appreciation of what they're up against and ways that you can help make sure that their habitat stays strong, and so that the animals' health stays strong.
This idea of creating a connection between people and animals as a means to protect the animals and their environment is something that was echoed by the Minnesota Zoo. I spoke with Michael Lee, who does communications for the Minnesota Zoo. We talked about the Medtronic Minnesota Trail, which features animals from around Minnesota.
The core mission of the Minnesota Zoo, everything revolves down to saving wildlife. So our mission is to connect people, animals, and the natural world to save wildlife. So a big thing for us here at the Minnesota Zoo is if we aren't educating people about the species that people can find in their backyards, one, a lot of people will take them for granted, and then two, it's really hard for people to have that passion or that empathy to want to protect them in the wild, or at least their spaces, the natural environment that we live in.
Jay is one of those people who really has a love for the animals and their environment. He's so passionate about it that I assumed he'd always wanted to work with freshwater fish when he was growing up, but it turns out that was far from the case.
I was actually a music major to begin with, and that's what I wanted to teach music. And it was quite some time ago now. I was in Baltimore, and there's an aquarium there called the National Aquarium of Baltimore. It's in the Inner Harbor. But went to the aquarium and was just blown away. I was like, oh, this is what I want to do, you know. And I think it was actually at the dolphin show when I watched these beautiful dolphins flipping in the air. I'm like, this is what I'm going to do. I want to do this the rest of my life. Started my college career as. It was a technical program in aquaculture. And that's focused on freshwater animals. It had the same sort of ideas and principles to taking care of animals in an aquarium. In a saltwater, but I really was focused on saltwater. That's what I wanted to do at that time. But at the whole time that I'm going to school about this, I'm also learning about freshwater fish and learning about freshwater environments. And even though I kept trying to take this avenue of wanting to learn about saltwater species, I kept kind of getting knocked in the noggin of these cool things that are happening in freshwater.
Jay's first job in an aquarium was at Underwater World at the Mall of America, which is now known as Sea Life.
I've had my dream to finally start working with saltwater fish, but yet was pulled more. I found myself kind of gravitating more with the freshwater fish because I had learned so much about it and realized that not as many people were paying attention. Professionally, I took a job as the curator of the aquarium here. And so it was a step in a different direction for me, a step up in my career. But then also it was a really exciting project that was going on, and it was unique as to what we were doing, because it was going to be the world's largest freshwater aquarium, as we've been talking about. I was really excited at the opportunity to come up and to actually have a facility that focused on freshwater. It was definitely a challenge and different, and yeah, it just, that was one of the a lot of different reasons why I wanted to come up this way.
And you can tell that Jay just really loves his job. He showed me around the entire aquarium, and at every exhibit he had a story to tell.
Right over here we have the our Lake Superior display, which I'm really proud of. It's our largest aquarium in the facility. It's 45,000 gallons. It's 26 feet deep. It's filled with lake trout and different species of trout and eel pout and sturgeon, and I'll show you that in a second. And then, of course, right here we have the otters. And I was showing my mom this facility when we opened it, and I was very proud of it. I'm like, oh, look at this tank. And we just got done looking at the otters, and I'm like, oh, what do you think of this aquarium? She goes, yeah, our fish are kind of boring, aren't they? I'm like, oh, we didn't reach that one. But she's like, oh, let's go look at the otters again. All right, we'll go look at the otters again.
Hearing Jay talk about the aquarium made me interested. I wanted to hear about the smallmouth bass, which, for the record, are Jay's favorite fish. By the end of the tour, Jay had done what he had set out to do. He showed me that there's a lot of cool stuff going on with the local animals, and it's worth taking a look at. For Real College Podcast, I'm Jacob Maldonado McGee.
Next, we have a story Jacob did about the Unlords, a Puerto Rican leftist group that showcases Jacob's knack for personal storytelling and reporting.
Growing up Puerto Rican in mainland USA meant that I was taught US history, and there was very little mention of the tiny island of Puerto Rico. I didn't really think too much about it until I started hearing Puerto Rican artists like Princess Nokia and Hooray for the Riff Raff's Alienda Segara mention the Young Lords. A very basic Google search revealed to me that the Young Lords Party was an activist group of mainly Puerto Ricans that formed in the 70s. How in the world had I never heard of them before? That's when I reached out to Daryl Wanzer Serrano.
I am an associate professor of rhetoric and public advocacy in the Department of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa.
Daryl wrote a book called The New York Young Lords and the Struggle for Liberation. Like me, Serrano grew up not knowing too much about his Puerto Rican history, but always valuing that part of himself.
I was in what was supposed to be my last semester of coursework in my PhD program, and I had a professor who encouraged me to research something having to do with my Puerto Rican heritage, and she was the first professor to really do that for me.
Gerald picked up an anthology on Puerto Rico and found some writing from the Young Lords.
By the end of the semester, I had made the decision to do a dissertation on a new topic and to extend my coursework and really kind of start transforming my life in a lot of ways.
The Young Lords started out as a street gang that became political under the guidance of Jose Chacha Jimenez.
They stood for a lot of things. I mean, they were a grassroots street political organization that organized around the issues that were most important to the people in their community. So in New York City, those issues included garbage. That was the very first issue they organized around, was the lack of kind of trash pickup in East Harlem.
One of the most memorable things the Young Lords did as a party was testing the water for lead. They knew that the government had these lead testing kits, but they weren't doing the work to help the people, so the Young Lords decided to take it upon themselves. They picked up the kits and went door to door testing the water for lead. When I heard this, my first thought was that they reminded me a lot of the Black Panthers, and in some ways they are kind of like that.
The Black Panthers were definitely an organization that the Young Lords looked to for inspiration, looked to for kind of guidance on how to structure some of the things that they were doing and how to put in place some of the programs that they put in place.
They even followed the business model of the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers paid for their organization by producing a magazine called The Panther. The Young Lords had their own magazine called Palante. When you look at what they were fighting for, the groups diverged, though.
They were their own organization and identity. I mean, they weren't just trying to be the Puerto Rican version of the Black Panther Party. They weren't born of the of quite the same struggle against, even though they faced issues and dealt with issues of police brutality, they weren't organized from the beginning around that issue in the same way that the Black Panthers were.
One of the things the Young Lords was fighting for was independence for Puerto Rico. In this march, you can hear that they're telling Puerto Ricans to wake up so that they realize the oppression that they're facing. Another thing that set the group apart was the kind of art that was being produced by them. Many of their members were poets and writers, which is evident in copies of their magazines Palante. One of the pieces in the magazine talks about the solidarity between movements, saying, "Mi lucha es tuya, tu lucha es mía. Lo que importa es calor, valor y mucha camaradería," which translates to, "My struggle is your struggle is mine. What matters is the heat, courage, and lots of camaraderie." With so much rich history and art, I find it crazy that I'd never really heard or learned about the Young Lords before. I learned about the Black Panthers in school, but never the Young Lords. I asked Daryl about it. He said one of the big things is that the records weren't kept well. While writing this book, he had to go to New York and scan most of the copies of Palante himself. Another reason that the Young Lords may not be as widely known is because of the ambiguity of Puerto Rican race. Compare it to something like Black Lives Matter.
When you have groups of people who are making a claim to Black life, right, that tends to kind of stick in the national imaginary in a certain kind of way.
Puerto Ricans are hard to pin down. Racially, we exist in a space sort of between Black and white, so studying us can be a difficult thing. Daryl says there also just aren't a lot of Puerto Ricans who go into academia and study this kind of stuff. But for him, studying this was life-changing.
My Puerto Rican identity had been an important part of my life, at least the way that I would label my life. But really, like, coming into contact with that that piece from the Young Lords, where, you know, it's written from someone who was roughly, you know, similar age to me at that time in my life, you know, in their kind of early 20s, late teens, coming to a kind of political consciousness at that moment, it really started kind of mirroring where I saw myself in my life. And so it was transformative in the sense that I was, for the first time, really seeing a bit of myself in something that I was reading about.
And although the Young Lords Party doesn't exist the way it used to, it's still influencing many young Puerto Ricans across the country. For Real College Podcast, I'm Jaca Maldonado Medina.
Finally, we have a much more recent interview Jaca did with the Minneapolis-based rapper and musician Dessa.
Being a fan of local music, especially here in Minneapolis, is a really cool experience. You get to witness firsthand how an artist grows and changes during their career, and I find that artists here in Minnesota are super nice to their fans and really sort of become friends with them. Anyone who knows me will know that I am a huge fan of Dessa. I first saw her at Rock the Garden in 2014, and ever since then, I've been keeping up on her music and her writing. I got to sit down with her right before Chime came out, which is out now. Go take a listen to it. It's super great. But this album is a little bit different from albums before.
I mean, writing is always a pretty solitary endeavor, you know? It's not something that you do, it's a tag team, usually. You know, it happens when you're alone. But yeah, sharing work when it was more malleable and then readjusting our course, you know, making course corrections as we went, was a little bit different. I think I was more flexible on this record. And also, I think I was trying less hard to impress with intellect. Like, you know, you're always aware of how you present, you know. We're aware of how our bodies look to other people, of how our voices sound, of the way we speak, and we're all kind of monitoring how that's being received. And I think on this record, I was trying to figure out how to communicate a little bit less, like, with less thought towards reception, and less, I had less to prove and more to say, I think. There's a song called Ride, which is the first song on the record, that I remember thinking, ooh, do I feel comfortable putting this out?
Baby, put that out. I don't let nobody smoke in here. You sounded woke on the telephone, but faded you don't say much.
You know, it doesn't have a lot of fancy words in it. It talks more frankly about, like, a kind of dystopian perception of political current events. It talks more frankly about, like, a it hints at a dissatisfying, like, hookup. And, yeah, and saying, I'm going to roll with that. That's also part of my true lived experience.
Another thing that has influenced this album is an experiment that Dessa underwent. I'm not great at explaining it, so I'll just let her do the explaining.
Yeah, so as part of my performance with the Minnesota Orchestra, I knew that I wanted to have, like, a narrative run through the night that would sort of, like, serve as a scaffolding for each of the songs to sit on. And I was also going through, like, a breakup that took, like, 10 years to stick. And so after feeling pretty blue, like, as a person offstage, I contacted a team of neuroscientists to see if I could locate the region in my brain in which romantic love resides. And to do that, I was referencing a lot of published material. So pay my respects here to Dr. Helen Fisher. But I was lucky enough to be taken on by scientists at the University of Minnesota, led by a team of scientists led by a woman named Dr. Cheryl Ullman, and this neurofeedback clinician. So that's the person who would, like, stick electrodes to your head to measure your brain waves and maybe try to change them. And her name was Penny Jean Grace Fire. And yeah, over the course of several months, we tried this kind of case study where we measured the love in my brain. We did an experimental intervention to try to change the way that my brain waves behaved. And then we re-measured the love in my brain to see if it did anything.
And in the end, the experiment worked. Her feelings were different. That led me to wonder if the music that I loved from Dessa was going to change drastically now that she wasn't in heartbreak, which is such an awful thing of me to be concerned about because she was heartbroken. But I couldn't help but ask.
It's not the case that all of a sudden, like, I'm a disco dance act. You know what I mean? After having had a really melancholy discography. But I think I've always been interested in sort of a blending of feelings. And I was initially attracted to Doomtree because I thought that there was these moments of beauty. I mean, the way that Cecil Otter, for example, handles strings and orchestral samples. Like, gorgeous. But there was also these moments of, like, aggression and unchecked anger. And my favorite stuff always, I think, has both of those things. There's an anger and there's a beauty. And so now, after having done this case study on my own brain, I think a lot of that experience finds its way into the music, even just in asking the questions that I was asking during that experiment. Like, can you decide to love somebody? I don't know. In the same way, like, I'm at the doctor and they hit my knee with the little mallet, I don't decide to kick my leg. That's just reflex. I can't help but react that way. Is that how love works? Like, is it a choice? So, like, on the record, there's a song about free will. And in part, you know, I think that's a product of my rumination during that time. Yeah. And there's one, like, straight-up unapologetic summertime pop song. So.
Chime is out now. You can listen to it on Spotify, Apple Music, all the places. You can buy it at doomtree.net. Thank you so much to Dessa for sitting down with me. I talked to her for a full 40 minutes, so we can probably publish the full interview if that's something anybody's interested in. The song playing right now is Velodrome. That is the song that Dessa was saying is about free will, and it is one of my personal favorites off the album.
Don't believe my will's quite free. I'm half machine, at least half steam. Aquinas, call on me. How many angels on the head of your pin? Anybody in stilettos can answer that old thing. It's one for the right foot.
Finally, I asked Jaika about what her favorite part about working at Radio K was and what she plans to do after she graduates.
Yeah, I'd definitely say, like, the people are the most amazing part, especially Real College Podcast people. You meet so many really amazing people at Radio K, and, like, specifically the podcast. Like, the podcast really becomes your family. Met a lot of just, like, amazing people who are, like, some of my closest friends and people who I, like, treasure dearly and who are going to do so many, like, amazing things. And I'm like, oh, it's cool because I get to say, like, oh, I knew that person when they were at Radio K and now they're out there doing really cool things. I think I'm going to try to get a job as a producer, either for a news show or a podcast. That's sort of the big goal. If not, then do some freelance reporting, audio reporting, and see sort of where that takes me.
That is all for Real College Podcast this week. Real College Podcast is produced by Liv Riggins and Ben Hallam. Jacob Maldonado Medina was our host and managing editor and is now going to go out in the world where she will hopefully produce many other amazing audio stories. I, Alex Schumacher, am now the host and managing editor of Real College Podcast. RCP is a production of Radio K, Real College Radio, and you can hear us over their airwaves every Monday at 6:30 p.m., or you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. That's all from RCP this week. See you next week.